Welcome to DigiCode, the podcast for innovators to contemplate and discuss the innovations of tomorrow. I'm your host, Tarun Nadapati, and today we're going to talk about Hadrius and Soam Mohapatra. One of the brightest minds at a UVA, Soam co-founded QuantBase with Thomas Stewart and got admitted into Y Combinator, where they later pivoted to pursuing Hadrius and the AI compliance space. Since graduating Y Combinator, Hadrius has seen significant growth and is now projected to reach about 10 million ARR by the end of this year, and is providing services for customers collectively managing $2 trillion. So if you want to learn about how to successfully start and grow a startup, this episode is for you. We'll be diving into the beginnings of Soam's story, what support structures helped him along the way, what mindset and methodologies he needed to have to grow and manage his startup, and finally, what moments he needed to learn to adapt in order to find the right opportunities for growth. So without further ado, let's DigiCode. Soam, it's great to have you here, man. It's been such a long time. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me, man.
And of course. I think the last time we talked, I was in college, and you were at the start of Hadrius, just out of college, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's amazing. How have things been? You're in New York now. You're building the office there. Is the company everything there?
Yeah. So okay. We're about 2.5 years old. Got like 25 people on the team. We're growing to like probably 50, 60 by October. So just a lot of hiring, lot of growth, really exciting stuff. Yeah. And we're all in New York.
Wow. That's amazing. how's life been otherwise? Getting to enjoy Yankees games, hopefully, or anything fun in the area?
At this stage, it's all just kind of grinding, focusing in on the work. It's New York, so there's always something fun going on.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. So for our audience, just to kind of give a quick primer, I know the amazing things that you do, but could you just give a quick background on, how things got started? What do you do now? And a quick primer on Hadrius.
Yeah, sure. Appreciate the chance here. So I'm Soam. I'm the founder at Hadrius. This is my third company. I started my first one. It was kind of stillborn my first year at UVA. My second one was an investment firm where I actually met my co-founder in college. Grew it to kind of, I'd say, mid 8 figures in assets under management. In about 6-7 months, sold it, and then kind of realized that, well, our most expensive software is compliance software, and it all kind of sucks. So we built some stuff in-house, and I'll get into the story later, but that's what got us to start my current company, Hadrius, which is, using AI and agents to automate the boring stuff when it comes to SEC and FINRA investment compliance. As I said, we're about 25 people on the team. We're growing to 50 or 60 in the next 4 months. And we've got, we're on track to hit 10 million in ARR by the end of the year.
That's amazing, man. I think for me personally, in all my I've tried to grow in college, and with all the entrepreneurial questions, you've always been the person that I've went to, and you've always been there to support me. So appreciate you coming on the podcast to help me kick this off. I heard you're a Richmond kid. You went to Maggie Walker, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. grew up moved to Richmond when I was like 5 years old, and went elementary, middle, high school, all there. Both of my co-founders are also from Richmond.
Oh, no way. Okay. They also go to Maggie Walker?
No. One of them's from Fredericksburg originally. One of them's from Spotsylvania originally. But, when we started, we all lived in Richmond. One of my co-founders went to UVA. The other went to VCU.
Gotcha. Okay, that's amazing. And in UVA, you studied econ and CS?
That's right.
Okay, gotcha. So can you tell me a little bit about, I know like in your time at UVA, how, because everything kind of got started there, right? How did UVA kind of help you, foster those entrepreneurial dreams? Were they there already? And, you know, what kind of helped when you were at UVA?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I've talked at a few other places about this, but essentially I wrote my college app to college, pretty much saying that I'm probably going to drop out to start a fintech company.
That's crazy.
It's funny because that's exactly what ended up happening. My second year, obviously, COVID was going on, so everybody was doing college from home or from the dorm rooms.
Yep.
I took all my classes pass fail and just went hard on figuring out, like, just before I even had an idea, just knowing I'm going to do something. I'm going to figure out some company idea. At the time I was like, and I still am a huge fan of like every Paul Graham essay imaginable. He's the founder of one of the founders of Y Combinator. So I ended up finding a couple co-founders around that time. And, you know, when I wasn't doing schoolwork or whatever, I was working on my second company at the time, which was QuantBase. And then it's kind of funny, my third year, I actually came back to school and I was going to be an RA. So I had like the pre-semester RA orientation, it's called O Week. And then the day before my kids were supposed to come in, we got funded. We've been raising VC funding over the summer. So we got funded and I had to send an email out saying, hey, folks, I'm actually taking this year off. I'm taking a gap year to see where this company goes. And that gap year has turned into, or it was a gap semester first, which turned into a gap year, which turned into two, now three gap years, maybe even more at this point. And, it's hard to imagine going back now.
Yeah. So till date, you haven't graduated college. Is that right?
That's right.
That's amazing, man. That's crazy. That's like the true, like Mark Zuckerberg, I guess now it's Soma Mahapatra, story. But that's amazing. So I guess like when you were at UVA, you said you got funding. Is that from like, that was before you got into YCOM or that's after?
Yeah, that's before YC. Okay. We raised, from pretty much family and friends, our first $200,000-$300,000. And actually, it's kind of funny. Our very first backer, was one of my friends, who, I joined an investment club at UVA, with, and, from there we ended up getting some institutional VCs in, and for our first round, we raised about $500,000 for our pre-seed.
Wow.
And that was that was before we had any network whatsoever in YC, or in the investment space. And then we only did YC about 5-6 months post fundraise into the journey.
Gotcha. Okay. So interesting. So your story with QuantBase started, way before YC. It started what in your like second or third year, you said?
Yep. Second year.
Okay. Okay. So, and then, so it started in second year and you decided to take a break, from school to like really build that out. What was that time like when you were, building it out? Was it like in your dorm rooms? Did you guys get like the WeWork at the CodeBase building or, how did it work?
Yeah, great question. It was, it wasn't a WeWork. It was pretty much like a local WeWork kind of thing in Richmond, about 5 minutes away from, where my co-founder and I used to live, called a Gather. And I still remember there's a little, we rented one desk, shared the desk. It was about, $50 a month, all out in the open. We didn't have our office or anything like that. And we committed to going there every day. Right. So, I left school, my co-founder, who was a couple years older, one of my co-founders, before we met our third one, he quit his job. And so we were all in on this thing. And so this would have been, what would have been my third year of college. Most of it I spent in Richmond working on Pompeii, just, you know, either from home or from like a library near home or this kind of, you know, Richmond co-working space. And then what would have been, I guess that was my first semester of third year. And then what would have been my second semester of my third year, we decided to just move to New York. We realized we were building an investment firm. Like a digital wealth advisory, like a Wealthfront or a Betterment kind of app, and yep. So we decided the density of opportunity here is in New York City, so we decided just pull up all our roots and move to New York, and it was only I'd say so we were there for maybe 3-4 months, then we got into YC, and so we moved to SF for what would have been the start of my fourth year. And then finally, after YC, we found the idea for Hadrius during the Y Combinator batch, and then we moved back to New York, and it's been about a year and a half, almost two, since then.
Wow, that's amazing, man. And so, okay, before we move on to your time at Y Combinator, did any like infrastructure, I mean, just for like anyone who's trying to build out a startup in college, did you feel like there were any resources within UVA, whether it was like the local entrepreneurial network or whether there's like mentors there that helped you refine that idea or bring it into a path, or did it all kind of come internally?
Yeah, so we got really lucky. I met my one of my co-founders, the one from UVA, literally in the what was it called? There was an entrepreneurship group me, and I think it's still pretty active. That's how I met my co-founder. Wow. And I think that group chat or that group me is now, I know there's at least two acquired founders in there that sold their, you know, startups for, you know, at least seven figures.
Yeah.
There's a couple, you know, there's now a good number of folks that have gotten into YC since we got in, back in 2023. And, yeah. You know, it sounds like, you know, when we were at UVA, the entrepreneurship kind of network was still just kind of getting started. I think now it's starting to get pretty healthy.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's amazing. I mean, it's always been such an inspirational group, and I feel there's always like a lot of people coming back in there. You know, I recently heard like Marty Weiner came back to Charlottesville and is starting to get engaged there. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot I feel that like, you know, college really helps with. And I feel like that was one of the things that connected me with you. You know, once you stepped away from college, you moved to Richmond, you started working in this Gather, and you got into YC. How did you got in with QuantBase, is that right?
That's right.
Okay. And how did that story work? Like, what was your application process like? You know, what was that? I think I remember you put in like a video or a demo that you make, right? And what was that whole application process like for you?
Yeah, absolutely. And so this was actually the third time I applied to YC. The first time was with my first idea. The second time was with QuantBase when my co-founder and I had just met. So, you know, before we had revenue, before we, you know, had gotten like any sort of regulatory approval. And this was both of our third times applying to YC. And I think, you know, what made our application stand out was, one, that we had applied multiple times. Like YC literally says, you know, like applying more than once almost doubles, triples your chance.
Wow.
To get in. It just, you know, especially if it's with the same idea, it shows consistency and dedication, which, you know, you need a lot of that with a startup, because, you know, things aren't going to look up for most of the early phases. I think part of it was definitely the consistency. The second piece was revenue. By the time we had applied, we had, you know, $200,000 or $300,000 in annual recurring revenue with QuantBase, which, you know, nowadays it's almost a given. Like it's hard for me to imagine a startup getting to demo day during YC without $300,000 or $400,000 AR. When we applied, I think the benchmark for a company was to get to demo day with, you know, $150,000 or $200,000 AR. So the fact that we were applying with, you know, a little bit more than that, I think had our application stand out. And third, I think it was just, you know, you're not when you're applying to YC, you're being across, what, like 20, 30K, probably even more applications. And so you need to make your application stand out. It's, you know, it's not the place for narrative essays on like your dream, your, you know, why now, the vision, so on and so forth. It's getting to the details. You know, what's the magic moment for your users? You know, how are you making money? How will you make revenue? You know, how big could this get in as many, in as short of a paragraph as possible? You know, making it punchy, making it direct.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's great advice, man. I mean, and I think I was sitting here thinking, you know, I got rejected for the first YC application that I put, and I'm never getting in. But okay, that gives, I think, me and a lot of other people a lot of hope. So now, I mean, coming into talking a little bit about what you learned in YC, what is that process like? I mean, it's always been a fantasy, you know, to think that I'll be surrounded by a bunch of mentors who are like literally helping me. But like, what do you literally like learn there that helps you, you know, take this idea and take a bunch of founders who are maybe experienced just with like business classes in college and make them into, you know, enterprise grade founders?
Yeah. The founder, the mentors at YC are world class. You know, like we literally got, you know, one-on-one feedback from folks that, you know, were billionaires, you know, had sold their startups that had made, you know, 100 million ARR and, you know, so on and so forth. One of the things I think is almost even more important than that is the network itself. YC's got this internal community called Bookface. It's play on words for Facebook. Imagine like a personal, private, like Twitter or Facebook or what have you with just startup founders that are grinding, that are like learning these truths about the world, right? Like how to, you know, how to get your first million ARR, how to, you know, get your first 10 million, how to do these like super specific tactical things that, you know, you don't really get to hear about, you know, generally. One of those things for us was how to pivot your company. When we got into YC, we had applied with QuantBase and we'd gotten in. But about a month in, we realized, you know, one, we were the first YC batch after ChatGPT came out. So, you know, one, this is generational technology. You know, QuantBase is a cool, fast-growing investment, you know, digital investment tech company. But, you know, maybe there's something bigger we can build with AI, right? So, you know, one was we wanted to see maybe this generational AI tech could be useful. Two, we're starting to realize that, you know, QuantBase could be the $100 million idea, but not the billion or even $10 billion idea. And three, this was like, you know, late 2022 when the market was kind of at a, you know, recent all-time low. I'd say, you know, recent time low, a local minimum. And so we realized, you know, obviously the market's going to go back up, but we didn't want to build a business that was at the behest of the S&P, right? And so all of these, you know, were our inputs. We reached out to folks through this Bookface network. How do we figure out what our next idea should be? So we were actually one of the, you know, part of the majority who applied with some idea and then, you know, and ended YC with a different idea. And I'll loop all this back to say, what was the most valuable part of YC? The mentors were amazing, but it was that network of other people who were trying the same things, trying to build a generational company that ended up being the most valuable.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's, I think, you know, for a lot of people who are just, you know, wondering what you actually get at YC, I think it's really great to hear you say that. And you know, the resources, they just sound, you know, absolutely phenomenal. In terms of, you know, the actual lessons, I know you said you read a lot of Paul Graham's essays. Are the lessons that are taught on the basis or the foundation of that, or do the mentors teach off of, you know, their own lessons, or is it a mix of everything? I guess I'm trying to understand, like, what is kind of that curriculum of, or the philosophy of that curriculum at YC based on?
Yeah, I'd say YC is very little of a curriculum and much more of a, you know, what might be like a, you know, when I need help, I can reach out to our mentors, our mentors to say, hey, like, what are we doing wrong here, right? And so it's very, you know, very specifically meant to be, you know, 99% of the time, it's just founders working with each other to try to build something cool, to try to build something people want. And then every week, one 20-minute meeting with our mentors of, here's what we're stuck at. How can we get unblocked? And it's meant to be, you know, and the mentors pretty much ask, well, what have you tried? Why didn't it work? What do you think, can be updated? And I think we found the most useful to be kind of like, what do you call it? Like institutional memory. Like, oh, your problem was something that the founders of Airbnb ran into when they started, in their YC batch, or Dropbox or Intercom or so on. So they were useful for institutional memory, for benchmarking, like, oh, the average YC startup that goes through a batch, you know, gets to 200K ARR. Like that kind of stuff is super, super useful that you can't really get anywhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's amazing, man. And I think what really resonates, you know, with me with what you said is that there's almost like a structure to the madness, but also like that free flow kind of aspect, in that like you're the one building it out, you're the one doing everything, and they're just kind of there to, you know, help contextualize your narrative with almost the broader patterns of what they see.
Exactly.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. So coming to, I guess, the more, you know, the meat of this this episode, you know, you started off with QuantBase. And I listened to one of the podcasts that you recorded during that time. And it seemed like there was a ton of passion from, you know, both you and your co-founders, Thomas.
Yep.
I think. Yep. Yeah. So, you know, both of you sounded so passionate about, you know, we're taking the algorithms that, you know, that are out there and giving it to like the people, the retail investors. But, you know, you're also like pairing it with like, you know, crypto access, with creator investing access. There were so many things which, you know, just resonated with a lot of passion. How did that, you know, how did you take that and apply it to Hadrius, which is more in this field of compliance, which a lot of people probably think is a bit boring, right?
Yeah. I love that question. It's really funny. A couple months before we got into YC, we had the you know, should we pivot conversation. So myself, my two co-founders, Thomas and Alan, and I was pretty much like, guys, I love investing, trading, like algorithm building. I'm really good at this. This is a passion of mine. So if we decide to, you know, pivot to something else, like I'll probably, you know, leave and have to kind of just, you know, start my own thing, right? Like I want to stay in this space. But we got into YC, we realized we needed to pivot, or, you know, we wanted to pivot. And I learned something about myself. It's not really the flavor of what we're building that, you know, drives me. It's the momentum, right? And I remember we had found the idea for Hadrius. We'd talked to like, you know, several dozens of people about what problems that they had, what were they trying to spend time and money on solving, but, you know, still came up short. Compliance was that thing. And specifically SEC compliance. So that's like all your investment companies. And I remember talking to one of my friends, who was also, you know, like had just left college, and the topic was exactly what you asked, right? Like, how do you build the passion for something that from the outside seems as, you know, as almost boring as compliance? And I pretty much told him, like, yeah, if you had told me 2 years ago I would drop out of school to start a compliance company, I'd be like, what are you talking about? Really what it is it's solving problems for people. It's making something people want. Our very first customer, was this like solo, you know, investment advisor, you know, brick and mortar, classic investment advisor. And he was using some like crazy, like complex Excel spreadsheet. And we were able to solve his problem for just $200 a month with software. And this guy was like our very first champion. He like posted about us on LinkedIn and stuff, and was like, you know, these guys are doing something really, really cool. Our 15th customer was like, Sam, you're selling me this crazy thing. If this does even half of what you guys say it will, you guys are going to be a $1 billion company. So it's these kinds of things of making something people want, really, you know, giving them something that like, you know, delights them. That's my momentum. That's what got me obsessed about compliance. And that's what, you know, keeps me obsessed about SEC FINRA compliance and about kind of where Hadrius is going.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, it definitely, you know, each founder has their own, you know, thing of what drives them. And I think we all think that initially we come in with, you know, the space is what's most important. You know, this is what I've lived in, what I've loved. But what you're saying is that you've mainly been driven by that customer delight, you know, that aspect of being with people and building something that, you know, really makes them happy.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's amazing, man. And so, you know, when you, I guess, started trying to get your first customer, your second customer, I think now you guys are doing like $2 trillion, you know, plus dollars of AUM in business. But, you know, when you guys first started, how did you kind of build that trust with that first customer?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what made us pretty lucky was, you know, every single investment advisory firm, like, or broker dealer, like a Robinhood or an, you know, M1 Finance or, you know, you name it, like anything where you, any app or any business you can give your money to manage or trade, they're required to have somebody wear the chief compliance officer hat, the CCO. And so when we were running QuantBase, which was also a, you know, regulated investment advisory firm, it was me and my two co-founders, and, you know, we flipped a coin who was going to wear the CCO hat. I got it. And so I was the one interfacing with our regulators. When the SEC came knocking, I was the one talking to them. I was the one buying, you know, compliance software. And so I kind of knew what I was doing. And that definitely helped. When we sold to our first customer, again, he was a solo, you know, a solo advisor. He also was wearing his company's CCO hat. And so, you know, our first probably 10, 20, 30 customers were that archetype. They were the kinds of folks that it was the founders wearing the CCO hat, and, you know, who could relate to me both on the compliance end, but also on like the founder slash business owner end, where they're like, just automate this thing for me so I can focus on what actually matters. And since then, we've kind of gone further and further up market to larger and larger companies that not only have like a dedicated CCO, but sometimes even a dedicated compliance team that can be, you know, tens, dozens, or even hundreds of people.
Wow. Wow. No, that's amazing, man. And I think, you know, what you said is that you kind of started with people who you really understood, right? In a sense that, like, because you were in that space with QuantBase, you've seen that struggle, you really leaned into that kind of customer type as your first customer. How did you make the transition, or how did you like cross the chasm almost, right? When you came from, you know, dealing with people who are, you know, solo advisors or people with the smaller size, and then your first talk with the CCO of a bigger, advisor. How did that conversation go? Was there any sort of mistrust that came with, you know, doing it your way versus the traditional way?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's always been a little bit of an iterative process, right? Like, you know, when we first started out, we had five customers, and, you know, people were like, well, how do I trust you if you have only five customers? And, you know, even today, we've got almost 400 customers. Sometimes that's not even enough for like the biggest firms in the industry. It's always, you know, when we started off, still now, people put their trust in who they're buying from, right? There's that classic slogan of like, people buy from people. Yeah, I mean, like when we started out, people pretty much just put their trust in me. They were like, okay, this guy clearly is obsessed. You know, it sounds like he could even do the CCO job himself, you know, for our company, because, well, he did it for his. And now we're, you know, as I said, we're a team of 25. We've got salespeople that are kind of doing the same thing. So when somebody is buying Hadria's software from Hadria, you know, from us, they're making that calculation in their head of like, okay, well, I'm buying from this person who I trust to be, you know, like a good operator. One of the heuristics, one of the rule of thumbs we have internally is, you know, for anybody that's customer facing, so our, you know, customer success team, our sales team, you know, our GTM team, they need to be good enough at Hadria's and at their at compliance to have a shot at being as good or even better than our customers at their own job. So like, can you be as good at being a CCO than someone that's been in the seat for 10, 15 years. Well, if not, then you've still got to keep learning. And like there's more to strive towards. Because once you get there, it's so much easier to sell the software because you can literally talk to someone that's been in the seat for however many years and tell them, hey, look, I've talked to 100 people that look like you. Here are the lessons I've learned. And, you know, because I know what what this seat entails, well, I have the taste to tell you what matters and what doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that kind of comes into like one of the core lessons that kind of goes into, you know, building a company, right? In that you're not really just building a product, but it's almost like you're supporting whatever, taking that their workflow and becoming an expert so much that, you know, they're able to trust you to just give you that workflow. Is that kind of how you dealt with things?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's amazing, man. What was, trying to backtrack just a little bit, what was the status quo before Hatreous? And what were you guys really trying to change in very like simple term?
Yeah. Yeah. When we first started Hatreous, AI was a curse word in the compliance world. Compliance was a curse word in Silicon Valley. And so when we first started, we were super lucky. We didn't really have any competitors that looked like us, that were startups, that were, you know, using AI to automate workflows. The biggest incumbents in this space are, you know, 15 years old. They still look like, you know, Windows XP. They hadn't really had a need to innovate because there wasn't any other company like Hatreous, you know, trying to compete with them. It's pretty interesting now, like 2 years later. Compliance is kind of cool now. There's been a bunch of companies that have jumped into not only SEC compliance, like I'm doing, but, you know, there's like SOC 2. There's all these other kinds of compliance that, like, you know, investors are funding that smart, young, obsessed founders are looking to automate. Like I literally talked to a friend today that's looking to jump into doing something in like, you know, mortgage compliance, you know, completely different from, you know, anything else that we're working on that I've seen. And like, there's still such a huge world out there to automate. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, how can you become passionate about a boring, you know, like a boring industry? I think honestly, that's, you know, like for the right founder, there's so much opportunity in that. Like, obviously people are going to be flocking to like your, you know, foundation model shops like your OpenAI or your Anthropics or so on. Or like, you know, UVA obviously has a huge like finance community. So like going to your quant places, your, you know, private equity, your hedge funds. But, you know, I think one of the keys to my, you know, team's success has been when we started Hatreous, we knew we wanted to build, you know, not only in a boring industry, but also in a traditionally kind of seen as boring industry, but also we wanted to build for the back and middle office. We wanted to build for like the pieces of these companies that software doesn't typically try to sell to.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was almost like you found this, you know, underserved, you know, area where people don't go because it's boring almost in a sense, in the traditional sense. And you were able to really change and shift the status quo from, you know, being very legacy to being very, very much more modernized. And that's, I guess you would say your main, you know, value prop.
Exactly. I'd say if there was a Venn diagram in 2023 of like, you know, people that knew compliance and people that knew good software, like the Hatreous team might have been the only team in existence with those qualifications. We were certainly the only ones in our YC batch to have had an idea even remotely similar to what we were working on.
Yeah, yeah. That's awesome. So can you tell me a little bit about how the actual product works? You know, I remember a little bit about emails, a little bit about like, you know, filtering things. But yeah, could you just remind me about how does that Hatreous actually work? What does it do? You know, and how does it create value?
Yeah. So compliance is all about pulling in as much data as possible and monitoring it for, you know, trends, patterns, anything that, you know, could be construed as fraudulent or, you know, like just, you know, unpleasant in general, right? And so we're pulling in emails, we're pulling in, you know, text messages. You know, these are all SEC guidelines and rules that, you know, all client communications need to be archived with some third party, right? Like imagine you're a 500 person firm. One of your, you know, one of the people on your team that's advising clients is telling them, hey, like, I just got this hot tip about some, you know, some random company, you should go buy it. And then like there's emails about that. Well, if the SEC came to that company and said, hey, like I need all your emails. Well, if you're that employee, if you're that advisor, you just delete that email and send the rest, right? So which is why a solution like Hadrius is almost like, or is pretty much required by compliance, but required by the federal, you know, by the SEC, you need to have email stored with a WORM compliant third party. WORM means write once, read many. So as soon as that email is sent, it gets sent to Hadrius. Even if it gets edited or up or deleted on Gmail, it stays on our servers. And any changes, et cetera, you know, manage an audit trail. So communications like that are important. It's that same idea for like any ads that go out. So whether they're, you know, like Google ads or, you know, social media posts or, you know, so on and so forth. It's that same idea for any trades that an employee makes in their personal accounts or that they make for an employee or for a client. Think about like a vanilla wealth manager that's talking to a household and saying, hey, you should invest X, Y, and Z. So we're pulling all the information in, and you can kind of get a sense of how language models are really, really good at this, right? Status quo, it's the compliance officer that's parsing through hundreds, maybe even thousands of emails and trades and seeing, you know, what might be an issue, right? And now we can offload some of that boring work to LLMs. And the CCO now has the ability to kind of work on a high level, right? Like they can look at, okay, what emails are coming in? What are the issues there? What are the issues with trades coming in? What are the issues with, say, ads coming in or, you know, going out? And then trying to, and becoming pretty much like the data wrangler, right? Like that's surveilling all this stuff at once.
Gotcha. And so the main purpose of the compliance role is essentially to make sure that there's no sort of insider trading or any other types of illegal activity happening in the company.
Exactly. Right? Illegal activity, essentially, that's, you know, like the SEC and FINRA are both government bodies whose job it is to protect investors, right? So retail investors, folks that might only have a couple hundred thousand or even a couple thousand dollars to invest. And that's the job of compliance, to protect not only, to protect not only the company from SEC fines, but to protect, you know, individual investors from losing their life savings.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that kind of links to, you know, going back to, you know, how you found the passion or the purpose. It really, the overall compliance industry and the way what you're supporting ultimately comes back to supporting people or adding a sense of authenticity or trust to that whole layer of investment. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Gotcha. No, that's amazing. And so, you know, when you were kind of coming back to the actual company building aspect of it, do you feel that your qualities or the way you are as a human being and the values that you follow were kind of embedded into the culture of that company? How did that culture like develop overall at Hadrius?
Yeah, I think so. There's a really good book by this guy Ben Horowitz. He's a, you know, capitalist, called "What You Do Is Who You Are," and you know, the gist of it is, you know, all these companies today have, you know, their corporate values, right? But your culture is pretty much, especially as a startup, it's like the stuff that you do, right? As soon as you go, you know, as you build a company from like two or three people, like the founders, up to like even 10, even 15, in our case, 25, what becomes really important is the culture. It's, you know, when the founders aren't in the room, what are all the kind of individual people in a team, how are they conducting themselves? And this isn't like HR, like conduct, but this is, what are the decisions they're making? Are they going to buy the plane ticket that's the cheapest, or are they going to buy, you know, what, like Spirit Airlines, or are they going to buy first class? How are they going to make that decision? What software are they going to are they going to buy the cheap software? Are they going to, build something in house? Are they going to outsource? What kinds of people are they going to hire? That's culture. And I'd say for us, the most important, I could list out our kind of five, cultural traits, but I'd say our most important one is, the one that's almost unconventional is optimize for the short term. Which is crazy, right? Because every book out there, every sage advice tells you, look, you look for short-term profits and your company is going down, right? We're at a stage right now where I'm still wearing I'm one of our chief salespeople. I'm one of our chief product managers, we're still in the stage of small decisions about the product are going to matter a bunch in the future. And the way we make those decisions is revenue. Revenue is pretty much the most important thing to our business. We're growing 20 to 30% month over month. And we've been doing so since the start of Hadrius. And you can't do that without, focusing, what are we going to build that's going to hit our 20% or 30% growth this month? And so what we found is, we're building a company, we're setting these crazy targets for ourselves on a monthly basis, and we're building the company into one that can actually hit those targets.
Gotcha. And so that's why you say it's because, one, it's a function of, how fast you're growing, and two, the nature of sales itself, that you really focus in on optimizing the short term.
Yeah. And I think that cultural trait is going to change, as companies grow, cultural can and do change. There's a really funny story, Amazon, up until there were 100 people, they literally had Home Depot desks as tables. They went to Home Depot Home Depot doors. They used doors and fashioned them into tables.
That's insane.
And that's because one of the cultural traits of Amazon was, and to some extent still is, the something about being, lowest cost for the customer. Mm. Right. And there's another company out there, I think they're Fog Creek Software. They were a really big company in the early 2000s, and I think they're still around. All of their employees were required to buy first class tickets when they were going on business trips. Well, that's kind of weird. That's an unconventional cultural trait. The reason was these guys were enterprise software. And if you're going to be the kind of sales rep that is, asking for the $10 million deal, you can't be the person that's buying Spirit Airlines and, living in your, motels. That's one of their things that they said, well, these are the kinds of people we want on the team. Here are the kinds of decisions. Here are the kinds of things we want them to ask for.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's amazing. And I think it really also pairs with the idea that your culture, one, is the way you do things, right? In the sense that whatever initial practices that you start building out become the company culture, because that's how you're solving problems. But it's almost the idea that you build a culture around, what serves your market the best, or how you really get success in whatever market you're serving. No, absolutely. That makes complete sense. So I guess in terms of, your management style or the way you, hire, how does, that the culture kind of reflect into that? Do you try to find people who optimize for the short term, or what are you kind of looking for when you, hire your employees?
Yeah, hiring-wise, I'd say our rule of thumb is, what matters the most is grit and coachability. Mm-hmm. And so we're just like every startup out there, or like a lot of startups out there, grit matters a bunch to us. How hard can you work? It's not just about hours, but it's about the intensity, the obsession of those hours. And one that, I don't really hear talked about that much is coachability. So clients is a fairly, technical might not be the right word for it, but you can't come into compliance selling or building compliance software without really knowing the problems to solve here. And so conventional wisdom told us that you want to hire people that are subject matter experts to to sell compliance software. One of the things we found is that's definitely important. I call that like the y-intercept, you know, like how much you already know coming in. But even more important than that is the slope. How quickly can somebody, you know, learn all there is to know and more about, you know, about an industry or about, you know, what it is they're selling. So that coachability piece is something that's really, really important to me. One of the things that I do, especially when we're like hiring people that are from outside the industry, is my first call with them is like a 15-minute screening call. My second call with them, or like if the screening call went well, I send them materials on, you know, here's all the information about our biggest competitor. Now, next call, they pitch me, they try to sell that competitor to me, the competitor's software.
Wow.
And
yeah,
it's with very little information. And so my, what I look for is how quickly have you grokked that information on this competitor, on their product? And we've had folks that demonstrate just really, really strong learning. They can learn that stuff really, really quickly. And they've been some of the best contributors to our team.
Wow. Wow. And in terms of, you know, the coachability and the grit that kind of comes into play when you're actually, you know, selling, do you feel like, you know, the types of people that you hired when, you know, you guys were three people old, is the same type of person that you're hiring now when you're 25, and will be the same kind of person that you hire when you're 50 and 75?
Yeah. I'd say the answer is definitely not. It's, you know, it's kind of funny, like every time we go out and hire, we've got to rebuild our playbooks. It's because like every 3 months we've, you know, maybe even doubled or tripled revenue. And so we're a different kind of company like every quarter. And so even if we're hiring every like 3 or 4 months, which is, you know, relatively quick for a hiring pace, we just, you know, like we're always looking for someone new, right? When we were early on, I think it was useful to find folks that, you know, didn't know anything compliance related, but were really good at, you know, maybe founding sales or founding engineering. And now that we grow and mature, maybe it's true that we need folks that have, you know, some gray hairs, right? So that they can go talk to our enterprise clients, or they can build some really specific niche features and so on and so forth.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. That makes sense. So, you know, shifting the conversation a little bit to, you know, this idea of growth, I know you mentioned you guys were growing and have been growing about 20 to 30% year over year. Growth is a very like abstract concept, right? In the sense that, like, of course, it's revenue, but even that sense, you know, it ultimately boils down to, you know, certain strategic initiatives that you guys are taking and certain things. So how do you structure growth in your mind? What are the key, you know, I guess, yeah, KPIs that you guys are measuring, and how are you trying to, you know, optimize those?
Yeah, so I think there's been like there's really good advice here, which is you don't want to like overdo it with KPIs and like OKRs and all that kind of stuff. We focus on one big number, and that's, it's pretty basic for us. It's revenue. We have different ways we might break that down. So like for our sales team, for our marketing team, for our engineers, like what are the things you can do on a weekly basis to help us hit our goals? But it's all around that, you know, that high level pie in the sky goal of revenue growth. And, you know, your typical company in our stage is doing like annual, you know, revenue numbers. Like, well, by the end of this year, we're expecting to hit this number and, you know, like forecasting towards it. For us, we found that having like monthly goals is even more valuable. So, and the reason for that is, at least from like a GTM side, like a go-to-market sales, et cetera side, I found that like it's the couple weeks before a goal that people become superhuman. They figure out ways to close deals and like generate revenue that they wouldn't have ever figured out before. And so if you've got quarterly goals, or, you know, let's say quarterly goals, you have four goals in a year. So you've got maybe 4 weeks of superhuman, you know, nature, superhuman ability in the team. If you've got monthly goals, that turns into 12 weeks of superhuman nature on the team. And obviously the more time our team can be superhuman, the more they can punch above their weight.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, I guess one tactic that you're talking about is this monthly goals aspect. Can you talk to me about, you know, a time when, you know, you felt like the team didn't hit a goal? what did you kind of distill that down to? I mean, was it like a, you know, did you realize it was a people problem and you figured out a way to, you know, talk to the people and remotivate them? Or did you feel like there was something outside, external in the market that you really had to, you know, deal with? Yeah, just talk to me about a time when things didn't go so smoothly.
Yeah. So, we're small enough that like external factors aren't really that important for us, at least just yet. Internally, we've got a rule of thumb, which is sales hits this month's goals, engineering hits next month's goals, and hiring hits the month's goals after that. So if we miss this month's goals, well, there's a few things we can think about. One, well, we can talk to the sales team. You know, why did we not hit our quota this month? Is it because of, you know, leads, close rate, you know, something like that? Like that's where we diagnose. But then we look at the engineering team. What were the things that were on our built, like that were on our docket to be built last month that, you know, failed to hit our goals this month? And then finally, who are the kinds of people that we didn't hire 2 months ago that had us fail this month's goals? So, you know, now pulling that back, if it's this month, so it's July 26th, pretty much we're on track to, you know, hit our goal in August. Well, we know what our goal is going to be. Sales knows what their goal is going to be. For September, engineers know what they need to be building, what they need to be focused on getting shipped in August so that we hit our goals in September. And what me and my co-founders are thinking about is, well, in October, where do we want the company to be revenue-wise, so on and so forth? Who needs to be on the team now or in the next month or so to hit our October goals?
Yeah. No, dude, you're a true operator, man. Operating office, that's insane. No, I mean, just the way you're, you know, destructing or, you know, the whole problem and then addressing each component and then building it back up is, you know, truly inspiring. You know, in terms of, you know, the way things are going to go, you know, for the next 1 year, for the net to the next five, what would you say is the next thing for Hadrius? You know, what do you see in terms of technology? What do you see in terms of, you know, your path forward? And what are the things that are going to be the most important for you in the coming years?
Yeah. So we'll have probably a couple really cool announcements soon to pair with like our employee growth. But, you know, like we're hoping to hit 10 million ARR by the end of this year. It seems pretty much inevitable that it's happening. Looking forward from there, like, you know, I see a path to, you know, 30, 40 million ARR by, you know, by end of next year. And then, you know, 100, you know, 150 plus, you know, the year after that. For us, it's all about how quickly can we grow our revenue? How quickly can we serve customers and, you know, just, you know, create value, capture some of that value. Technology-wise and just market-wise, I imagine, you know, we're in this SEC FINRA niche, you know, within the kind of securities compliance industry. We're already having customers, you know, global, you know, really large customers asking us, well, can you help us do compliance for our UK entity, our European entities? Expansion on those lines is, you know, almost inevitable. We also have some companies that might have like an investment firm right next to an insurance firm and so on that under their entities that might need, you know, different kinds of compliance, like insurance compliance, public company compliance. You know, we've broken compliance down into like it's, you can call it like it's atomic particles. And I think, you know, my bet, the bet for Hadrius is that we can generalize these across the industry. So what Salesforce did to the CRM, we'd like to do for compliance.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And you'd say it's one, you're seeing that it's not really a cap on the market. You guys are still small enough that whatever function or the formula that you guys are operating on for growth now can continue to happen. And it's just a matter of going and getting it.
Exactly.
Okay. That's awesome. What do you see is a, you know, the next step for you? How do you want to evolve as a founder? You know, from now to, you know, the SOM that you're going to see in 5 years, what are the kind of changes that you want to see in yourself?
Yeah. So I think it really comes down to, like, look, the biggest team that I've ever led is 25 people, right? But you know, if we do our jobs right, we'll be 60 by, you know, November, maybe, 150 by this time next year, maybe, you know, many, many hundreds by this time 2 years from now. And so I think it's just learning how to be, you know, like even more than sales, even more than engineering, even more than product, even more than customer success. You know, people say that the hardest job is being a leader, being a manager, like handling people. And so I just got to figure out how to do that.
Truly inspiring. So thank you again, you know, for coming on to the podcast. Really, really appreciate you always being there to support. And you know, I see you being, you know, up there, you know, one of the big leaders. You know, congrats again on your RegTech award. And I absolutely am sure that, you know, there's going to be so many more accolades and achievements out there for you. So wishing you all the best and thanks again.
Thank you.
Reflecting on the conversation, I think there's a few key takeaways here. One, a founder's job is to delight his customers. When I think back to the story that Soam told about the pivot from doing quant-based to going to Hadrius, I think what I saw was a shift in passion from being passionate about the mechanics or the sector that he was building in to being passionate about just building something that makes people's lives better. And to me, that second mindset seems to be more sustainable and a guiding star for something when you're building something that really matters. Two, sales hits this month's goal, engineering hits next month's goal, and hiring hits the month after that. I think this was a great way to think that Soam just laid out when you're managing a company, and it's definitely a great way to keep people accountable and nimble in such a fast-changing environment. Three, the network is the most important resource that a founder can have. Whether it was the YC network that helped advise Soam during the quant-based to Hadrius pivot, whether it was the friends and family that invested in Soam in his very first round, all the way to that first customer who posted on LinkedIn being a champion for the product, the network that Soam built really came into play in shaping the Hadrius journey and being there in those pivotal moments. So as innovators, we're all out there to build things that change people's lives. But it's most important to remember that we need an inner North Star, a mental framework to help get through time, and a network that's there to support us in those pivotal moments of our journey. So with that, thank you for listening and see you all soon.